coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's new marijuana commissioner is committed to getting recreational cannabis sales in the first state up and running soon.
We're making every effort to get this whole program moving as expeditiously as possible, but also, you know, in a way that is effective.
We sit down with State Marijuana Commissioner Josh Sanderlin. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about the push for more oversight of Delaware's volunteer fire companies. Arts Playlist gives us a sneak peek at the First State Ballet's upcoming season. And Enlighten Me features more stories from University of Delaware student journalists. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It's been over 2 years since the First State legalized recreational marijuana, and Delaware has yet to open any dispensaries within state lines. Rob Koop, the inaugural leader of the Office of the Marijuana Commissioner, stepped down in January, and the governor did not tap a new commissioner until last month. That new commissioner, cannabis attorney Josh Sanderlin, has hit the ground running as leader of Delaware's recreational marijuana market and says despite Delaware's challenges, he is confident in seeing a successful rollout. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich recently spoke with Sanderlin about the trials and tribulations marijuana business owners have already faced, as well as what consumers can expect moving forward.
You have over 15 years of experience with marijuana regulation and public policy. So for starters, just talk to me about how you got into the cannabis space, how your work in this field has evolved over the years, and how that led you to leading the cannabis industry in Delaware.
So I began while I was doing government affairs work here in Washington, D.C., about 2013 and 2014, we were hired by the city and county of Denver. And that time coincided with their transition from medical use to full adult use. So I got to get a really behind the scenes look. I would go meet with local officials, business owners, and get an understanding of how it was being implemented, what their issues were, and then come back to DC and talk to lawmakers here. Getting involved in things like the banking issue back then when, you know, I remember going to one store and they showed me their vault that was just for holding cash. And it was taller than I am. And I'm over 6 feet tall and just filled with cash and hearing all the horror stories. So at that point, I did that. We were with them. And then I came back to the firm I was working at, which was a very large firm, and said, I want to do this practice. I think cannabis is an underserved area and it's only going to go up and get more important. And they told me I was out of my mind, that they were a very large law firm and there was no way they were going to do cannabis. It had been decided. I had been there for 10 years and at that point decided, you know, I was going to break out on my own. So when I broke out, I went and started working with smaller companies here in DC, doing medical, but also getting ready for the eventual recreation, helping people comply with laws. I'm a Maryland attorney, so I started doing work in Maryland as well. I got hired here and there as I got hired by one company as an in-house general counsel. And it was a tech company that was in the cannabis space focused on social equity. As with tech companies, they don't always work out, but it allowed me to kind of get a more in-depth understanding of the social equity side of things and the needs in the industry. And as my career progressed, I went back to running my own firm and working exclusively with cannabis businesses. What I've learned over the years is that it's a very underserved community, a business community, lawyers, CEOs, CFOs. It's getting better, but, a lot of times as, I would be hired as outside general counsel by these, and I would end up doing, kind of all sorts of things, everything from my legal work all the way down to more COO type things. That allowed me to really see many facets of the industry, really understand from a business perspective what you're facing when you open one of these companies. And It really, still just continues to drive my desire to, take this job where I can have a real direct hand on the policy side of things, to help implement a program that is, safe, responsible, and transparent.
And so, just to clear this up ahead of time, there were some concerns raised by the Senate Executive Committee during your confirmation hearing around your involvement with some cannabis businesses in other states. So, per Delaware code, the committee requested you divest from those companies before your full confirmation in front of the Senate. So, you've since been confirmed. So, just wanted to check in. Are you fully divested from these companies as of now?
Yes, ma'am. To make it simple, I fully divested and just didn't even take buyouts. I just walked away from the companies.
So, jumping right in now into the nitty-gritty of everything, Delaware has clearly faced some challenges in getting its recreational market up and running. Adult use marijuana was legalized in April 2023, so we are now 2 years post-legislation, and there are still no recreational dispensaries in Delaware. There's a lot to tackle here, but let's start with the most recent advancement and then kind of work our way backwards. So, as of now, the last public update on the industry followed the governor's signing of a bill that fixed a technicality in Delaware code that was prohibiting the FBI from issuing the necessary service code for marijuana business lottery winners to go through the federal background check process. That service code has since been issued, although there is another bill in the legislature making an additional technical correction in relation to federal background checks. So, really, the question here is, where are we now? Are the background checks underway? And do we have any semblance of a timeline for when lottery winners will be issued a conditional license so they can begin opening their businesses?
Background checks are fully underway. We're doing it systematically. It's being done through DATE. We have actually already begun to issue licenses, conditional licenses. On my first day, we went down to Georgetown, Delaware, and issued a conditional license for a cultivation out down there. So that was literally the first thing I did when I took the job. And we are making a full press to start doing those as well, getting more and more out there, ensuring that, folks have the ability to get their businesses up and running, stop waiting, and start actually, producing product for the industry, especially industry or supply sides of the industry that require a long lead up time like cultivations.
Yeah, and so I believe via the code and in general, it makes sense to issue those licenses for cultivation and testing and manufacturing first, right? And then we'll get retail later. And then I believe they have 18 months to get everything up and running. So I'm curious, is there kind of a rough estimate of when the retail licenses will be handed out, or is that sort of dependent on how the back end of all the other businesses get up and running?
I mean, these are conditional licenses, right? So for us at this point, it's when they've supplied the things they're required to supply, we can get them up and running when they're conditional and allow them to start, entering into contracts they need to enter into, site location or site control. I don't think it's a matter of, hey, we're just going to wait until the end and then, throw them all into the system. We're working through them just as we're working through the cultivations and the manufacturers. Right now, the documents we have gotten back from the licensees, they just kind of lend itself to doing these cultivations early on. But there will be a focus on getting as many as these as we can get out, right? We don't want to wait any longer. We understand we've heard the industry, we've heard the advocates, we've heard the Delawareans. We're making every effort to get this to get this whole program moving as expeditiously as possible, but also, in a way that is effective, right? We don't want to be rushing just for the sake of rushing and then, end up making something worse by doing that. But
Yeah.
we are working expeditiously.
Got it. And so just to be clear though, as of now, no conditional licenses have been given out to retail facilities specifically.
No.
Another major roadblock for lottery winners has been finding a location to even open up their cannabis businesses, right? So Sussex County has practically implemented a de facto ban with its buffer zone requirements from sensitive areas, and nearly every municipality in the southern part of the state has banned marijuana business. But these types of zoning restrictions and all-out bans have also made their way up north, right? This is a problem statewide. So there is a bill in the legislature right now. In fact, it's on its last step before heading to the governor for signature that would prohibit retail marijuana stores from opening within 500 feet of a place of worship, school, childcare facility, and other sensitive locations. And this is a lot less than Sussex County's current buffer zone of 3 miles. Advocates in the space and lottery winners are widely supportive of the legislation, but opponents, particularly Republican lawmakers, argue the state is overriding local control, right? So I know your job is to enforce the regulations passed by the General Assembly, but how do you feel about the requirements in the legislation? And do you think Delaware could even have a viable recreational market without these changes?
So, I mean, first and foremost, you have to have the ability to locate a business to have a business. So it's important that these guys have that these companies have a place to go. That being said, issues of sovereignty between the state government and the local governments is way beyond my pay grade, and really cuts to the heart of democratic government. So, I'm not really ready to wade into those waters. If this bill passes and is signed by the governor, then I'll be able to implement that. If it doesn't, then that means we'll need to work even closer, even more closely with the counties and the municipalities to help them understand, that this is a legitimate business. This is not something that's going to ruin neighborhoods. And I think part of that really is, making sure that we get it's working with the counties, but it's also making sure we get this program going, right? As long as the program is stagnant, it's much easier to say that that opening these businesses will cause a problem. But once they're open and causing no problems, that makes that argument much harder to make and stand against. And I think, working with counties, working with local governments, and understanding their concerns is very important. We'll see in the next couple of weeks what happens with SB 75.
Yeah, another key part of legalizing adult use recreational marijuana was the creation of the Social Equity License Program. And this provision ensured a certain number of business licenses were granted to those who were disproportionately affected by marijuana prohibition and that they would receive financial support from the state when starting their business. And so to help fund this program, the legislature passed a bill creating conversion licenses, which allows medical marijuana dispensaries to purchase a license to also sell recreationally. Now, those medical dispensaries have not yet begun selling recreationally because under code, you as the commissioner can only authorize them to operate once other dispensaries are up and running. So these are two different licenses, but they are intertwined in a way. I'm curious with what you've seen in other states. What are your thoughts on how Delaware has set up conversion licenses, especially considering some argue these licenses give medical dispensaries an unfair competitive advantage, as well as your thoughts on the social equity license program and kind of how the two mingle?
So every state is wildly different in how they design their laws, how they implement their laws, how they reform their laws as they go. We're all learning on the fly here with cannabis. And one thing about the industry is not only are the laws different in each state, the consumers are different in each state. What works and doesn't work is different. The obstacles you face are different. I think thus far, from what I've seen, Delaware has done a superb job of identifying the need of providing licenses for to for that purpose, and then the funding stream that we are working on, I think, is leaps and bounds ahead of what I've seen in other jurisdictions, and will be much more targeted towards providing folks in the social equity category with the access to capital, which nobody really has in this industry, but especially folks that are usually fall into the social equity class.
And not just taking everything to a broader level, I don't think you would be here in Delaware if you didn't have faith in the state establishing a successful recreational marijuana industry. But based on your experiences in other states' programs, are there any changes or additions to Delaware's recreational program that you would make or think the state should consider moving forward?
I think, right now, the eye on the prize for us and for me is getting what we have open. Before we start, worrying about what's next. That being said, I think Delaware is excellently positioned to get our program going, right? Having come on board not long ago and coming from the outside in, I have a different perspective on everything, but I'll tell you this, the staff at the OMC, or my agency have, really done phenomenal job getting us to the point we are at. I know that doesn't get as much play in the media. A lot of times it's about delay, 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 but these folks have everything lined up. We are working really quickly, and the only reason we can work quickly at this point with me just coming in is because everything is set up and in place. So, you know, what's next? I don't know, but what's immediately next is getting us up and running.
There are several businesses in Delaware selling hemp-derived substances, which are legal currently under the 2018 U.S. Farm Bill via a loophole. So there have been concerns raised, particularly around young people having access to these products, but business owners argue strict regulations would put them out of business. So how do you think Delaware should proceed when it comes to regulating hemp-derived products versus these cannabis products?
Well, I mean, I arguing to somebody in the medical cannabis space or the recreational cannabis space that overregulation causes your business to go out of business doesn't really play well. You know, we are one of the most heavily regulated industries in the country, and that's for safety reasons, right? That, you know, do I think we overregulate in some states? Yes. You know, but that being said, we still operate and we are facing way more challenges. I think if something is intoxicating or something is consumed by people, it needs to be regulated. It needs to be overseen. We need to know what's in things. We need to inform consumers and make sure that everybody, you know, not everybody's a good actor in the business industry, right? There are a lot of us that are good actors, but there are ones that aren't. And being able to protect the public is, you know, our number one goal, I think, in regulating these products.
That's really helpful. Thank you so much, Commissioner. I think that's all that I have for you. Is there anything else you want to add or anything we didn't touch on that you think is relevant based on where the market is at now or where you see it moving forward?
No, I mean, I think there's just a ton of potential in Delaware. You know, you were right when you said earlier, you know, I wouldn't have taken this job if I didn't think that. And I'm, you know, I'm really excited to be, you know, in a position where I get to help, you know, stand up this whole industry in the state and make sure that it's, you know, it's done in a safe way that protects the public and provides access to consumers.
Thanks to Delaware's new marijuana commissioner, Josh Sanderlin, and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee takes a closer look at efforts to bring stronger oversight to the state's volunteer fire companies. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware's fire companies operate as individual entities with limited oversight outside of criminal cases. Some in the service say that's working well, while others want to see a standardized code of regulations and a certification process put in place statewide. This week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee looks into new efforts to add stronger oversight for fire companies in the first state.
Two white volunteer firefighters in Delaware face felony charges after what authorities are calling a hate crime. Jay Dronings and Jordan Hastings, then members of the Millville Volunteer Fire Company, allegedly chased an African-American EMT through the fire station with a noose, trying to get it around their neck. After the incident, Droney continued to make racist remarks to the EMT. The incident reportedly happened in February 2024, but Millville's administration didn't receive a formal report until April 9th of this year. They followed protocol by notifying Delaware State Police, which launched an investigation, and the Delaware State Fire Commission. But here's the issue. There's little the Fire Commission can do in response.
Unfortunately, the Fire Commission does not have oversight or legal authority over the fire companies in Delaware.
That's Sherry Lambertson, Executive Director of the Fire Commission. She says although the commission can make recommendations and encourage changes, it can't enforce them. The commission can only offer guidance and urge fire companies to strengthen inclusion and harassment prevention policies.
There are 60 separate corporations within the state of Delaware that operate as volunteer fire companies. They run and manage themselves by their own policies, procedures, and bylaws. So the state of Delaware is a regulatory agency.
There isn't an agency in the state that has authority over the fire companies. Civil issues are handled at the local level, and when crimes occur, companies are required to pass reports to the state police and the commission, which isn't allowed to act on those reports. And that's a big problem, according to some involved with the commission, especially when incidents like the one in Millville occur. Frank Fioravanti is an investigator with the commission.
We can bring them before the commission and have a hearing, but the commissioners can only make recommendations. That is it. They can't hold them accountable.
That's why members of the Fire Commission are pushing for more authority and oversight, including a statewide certification program and standardized rules. Volunteer and paid firefighters already have to go through training to be qualified for their positions, but there isn't a certification system for career or volunteer firefighters. EMTs are certified through the Fire Commission, and the certification that allows them to work can be revoked. However, there's no equivalent system for firefighters in Delaware, according to Fire Commission Chief Investigator Dave Truax.
The simplest thing is you have firefighters and EMTs working side by side. The EMT is being held to a different standard, and action can be taken against that EMT that can't be taken against the firefighter. And I really don't see the difference there.
Truax says it's up to fire departments to do the right thing. And in this case,
it sounds like Millville took appropriate action per their policies and procedures.
When the alleged crime was reported to the Millville Volunteer Fire Company, Droney and Hastings were immediately suspended, according to the company's public information officer, Gary Conitis. The company's investigation took less than 24 hours and resulted in the expulsion of both volunteers from the company and turning the case over to the police. From there, Conitis says company officials made policy changes.
One of the things that struck me through this whole particular event was that it can be difficult for the victims to come forward. And so we took steps in our policies to make sure that there's many avenues for them to report and that it's easier for them to report and try to do so as anonymously as possible.
The company also added training on anti-harassment, discrimination, and sexual harassment for volunteers and career firefighters and is already at about 80% compliance ahead of a September deadline.
This is going to be a continuous evolution. This isn't going to be a one and done. This is required to be done annually, and it is now a requirement of membership and employment.
These changes are in line with what the Fire Commission recommended fire companies statewide do following the alleged crime in Millville. But there's some pushback at the fire company's level against added bureaucracy. That includes Sussex County Councilmember Steve McCarron, who has been a part of the Bridgeville Fire Company for 32 years and previously served as president and vice president.
To me, it doesn't make sense. I would say this, if the state wants to get serious about certifying who's a firefighter in the state of Delaware, the state needs to stop being so lazy in their funding of the fire service in the state of Delaware.
All three counties commissioned studies of their local fire companies. Two are completed. Sussex County's study reported a drastic drop in volunteer numbers, which could indicate an impending shift toward career firefighters and funding troubles at some companies. Newcastle County's study concurs and finds the current fire model unsustainable. It recommends the county consider a, quote, more coordinated and integrated approach to providing fire and EMS countywide. It also suggests a gradual transition toward career firefighters staffing fire companies and being supplemented by volunteers. The Wilmington Fire Department is the only location in Delaware whose staff are fully paid. McCarron says he's in support of gradual change in the system, but an immediate change to a certification model could backfire.
I go back, I take my continuing ed, and I go to this and that. But at what point in time in my age do I just say, you know, I've got enough on my plate? And this was fun, but once again, I've got a family, I've got an occupation, and, you know, just a general person, and it becomes a serious burden on the volunteer.
Clayton Fire Company Secretary Kevin Wilson has been a member for 50 years and has served as fire chief, president, and public information officer. He's amenable to changes in Delaware's fire service, but like McCarron, he doesn't want the commission to go over the top.
We take this as a slow process, let's get something started. It's the old adage of how do you eat an elephant? Eat it one bite at a time. You know, the same thing with these standards. Let's get a personnel standard or a personal conduct standard, a training standard.
The current lack of oversight and a standardized statewide code leaves room for Droney and Hastings to re-enter the fire service in the future.
So yes, it would be possible that if charges were to be reduced, even dropped, that possibility would exist, that at some point they could go back to a fire department in the state and apply for membership.
And the Millville incident isn't isolated. In 2020, the former director and chief of the Lewis Fire Department, Bill Buckaloo, was suspended for using a racial slur on social media. He was selected again as chief of the same department just last year. A firefighter from the Cranston Heights Fire Department was also expelled and arrested in 2020 after sending racist texts to Black first responders. Fioravanti says there have been at least 5 serious behavioral violations in the last 5 years that the commission knows of. And while incidents like these aren't common, even a few can tarnish the reputation of the entire fire service.
It's that 1 or 2% that are bad apples, and they make everyone in that profession look bad.
McCarran agrees it's important to address those situations.
There is going to be instances where you've got a bad apple in there. It's just a numbers thing at that point, Tom. Once you get a certain amount of people, I do think the fire service in general does a good job of policing our own.
Alongside behavioral issues, the Fire Commission is also concerned about financial accountability. Just last April, a member of the Little Creek Volunteer Fire Company was charged with theft and unlawful use of a payment card, including 2 felonies. But Commission Chief Investigator Dave Truax says it has no authority to audit how fire companies manage their funding.
We have forged a relationship with the auditor's office that has not been there before, and through their efforts and our efforts, we are finding theft, misuse, and sometimes it's just a matter of not good, sound accounting practices. Nobody's doing anything wrong. They just are not keeping good paperwork.
The Fire Commission wants oversight power here, too, in order to keep track of company spending, Fioravanti says.
There's no accountability for that money. Once that money is turned over to the fire department, we don't know what they do with it. Hopefully they're doing the right thing, but what if they're not?
So, Fire Commission Executive Director Lambertson says seeking more accountability does not mean the commission is asking for complete authority, just a mechanism to keep things from slipping through the cracks.
What we're looking for is the ability to, where we have current or past cases that law enforcement hasn't had the staffing or ability to assist, we then have to close cases because we don't have the ability to investigate on a criminal level.
Lambertson says she envisions a mechanism that has the commission working alongside and supplementing law enforcement. McCarran sees things differently.
Justify to me, hiring people, we've got investigators, right, that are understaffed. How do we justify hiring investigators at a completely separate agency to investigate things that we do have personnel for if they were adequately staffed?
Standardizing policies and rules statewide could be a start. Wilson notes Delaware fire companies all have rules that look fairly similar, such as requiring their firefighters to attend regular trainings and their gear to be safe and effective in use. And he believes companies could work with uniform statewide standards.
As long as it's equitable and fair for everybody, and there's a way to enforce it for everybody, I'm all for that. You know, give me a standard, and we'll meet the standard.
McCarran concurs. He says there should be a blanket policy across the state for firefighters.
Having a sexual harassment policy, having a discrimination policy, those should all be things that is the expectation of every member. Certainly having a policy and a standard policy throughout the state of Delaware makes that much easier on the administrative side.
At Legislative Hall, the General Assembly's Joint Legislative Oversight and Sunset Committee has heard the Fire Commission's case for stronger oversight powers. But its chair, State Senator Kira Hoffner, says the committee does not plan to move on legislation regarding the Fire Commission this year.
I thought it would be best that we hold off this year and everyone sit down together over the summer and write a bill that everyone can agree on. Like, everyone agrees that background checks have to happen. And then the registration part, we're all coming to the table where we do want registration.
Those will likely be included in future legislation. Hoffner says the current process, which includes an in-state background check, could expand to a federal background check with enough support. Registration would help lay the foundation for potential changes to managing majority career firefighters by knowing how many are in each firehouse. If put in place, it would not act as a certification system. Hoffner says that step, and any other changes in the rules that guide firefighters' associations, firehouses, and what bodies control them, need input and buy-in. But she understands the push to move beyond the status quo.
just over the years, things have gotten a little muddied, but the commission has to keep in touch with the firefighters, associations, the chief. They're not supposed to be just going off and doing things on their own. Everybody should be at the table. And
Hoffner plans to include the Delaware Volunteer Firefighters Association, fire chiefs and presidents and representatives with the commission in conversations later this summer. With all of the players and stakeholders involved, Hoffner hopes all parties can feel represented and considered in rethinking oversight of Delaware's fire service. Abigail Lee, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Abigail. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we get a sneak peek at the First State Ballet Theater's new season. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. First State Ballet Theater recently announced the lineup for its 2025-2026 season, including Something Scary for Halloween, a mixture of traditional favorites and innovative new choreography, and a classic romantic masterpiece. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny speaks with the ballet's marketing director, Claire McGregor, about the upcoming season, as well as a trio of summer performances around the state.
This season seems to be a really interesting, really diverse season, and you're starting off right before Halloween with something pretty scary, right?
Yes. So the season opens in October, right before Halloween, with Dracula, which is, you know, this gothic, scary thriller that I think is perfect seasonally and will be an exciting start to the season.
And of course, we all know the story of Dracula, but I wonder, what does it look like on stage?
It's actually quite theatrical, and it's an exciting opportunity for the dancers to really delve into the, you know, gruesome and terrifying side of their personalities, which makes for a great performance.
And then coming up in November, we've got one of the really cool things that I think First State Ballet does up front. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about that.
Upfront is always one of my favorite performances of the year because it's such a unique setting. It takes place in Studio One at the Baby Grand, so you're not in the large theater. It's super intimate. You're in studio with the dancers. You can see the sweat. You know, you can see a little bit more of the work that goes into it, which I think can give people a new appreciation for how incredible the dancers really are. Because you don't often have the opportunity to be up close and personal with the dancers like that.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, it gives you sort of a ballet sampler in terms of you'll see some classical repertoire, but you'll also see some more cutting-edge contemporary stuff, right?
Exactly. It's a mixed rep program, so you'll get some of the classical pieces, the tutu ballets, and then more contemporary. So exactly like you said, it's a sampler. You can try a little of this, a little of that, and decide what it is you want to see more of.
And then moving into December, arguably the best known ballet of all time. If you've seen one ballet in your life, you've seen The Nutcracker, right?
Absolutely. It's the holiday blockbuster. And this is an exciting year for us because we're celebrating our 25th anniversary of the production. So it's exciting to think about some of those first shows versus the shows today and, you know, how far we've come, how the company has grown over the past 25 years, but also, how strong our commitment to artistic excellence has always been. And The Nutcracker is one of our best performances. For a lot of families, it's already a holiday tradition, and we invite everyone to come out and, you know, make it a tradition for your family also.
Coming up after the first of the year, this is in, I think, late February, is Dreams in Motion. We talked a little bit about contemporary ballet, and that's sort of what Dreams in Motion is all about, right?
Yes. Yeah, so this year, in February, we do usually do a contemporary-based performance, and this year we're doing something a little bit different. We're pulling two ballets from our archive that haven't been performed since their original premieres. They're both by Viktor Plotnikov, who is a frequent FSBT collaborator. And one is Fantasy to Dvorak, and the other is Nonsense in the Sense of Innocence. Fantasy to Dvorak, the premiere was a little bit more recent. It was just several years ago. And Nonsense was done, I think, over a decade ago. Both pieces have very striking costumes and very memorable costumes, and people ask us about them all the time. So we're really excited to bring them back, especially the Nonsense piece, which hasn't been seen in so long. And the movement is electrifying and exciting, and they're both a sort of fantasy and surrealist, whimsical evening that makes for a great evening of ballet.
Yeah, I was really kind of hooked by the title, Nonsense in the Sense of Innocence. I thought that was just a very striking title and kind of fertile imaginative ground for dance, I would think.
Absolutely. That's a great way to describe the piece. There's a lot of surprises in it, so I encourage everyone to come see it. You've really got to see it. It's just great. Like you can see in one of our photos, you know, she's got this almost Seussical hat. There's interesting props in that. So it's fun. And I think them both pieces together kind of makes for an interesting theme. And I hope everyone will come see it.
And then the season wraps up in April with kind of a big romantic ballet, right?
Yes. So we wrap up in April with Giselle, which is the tragic ballet classic. And it's the romantic ballet with the long white choo-choos. It's got some of the most iconic choreography. And it's, you know, such a dream role for any ballerina to be Giselle, because you've got to be so technically strong. But there's also this huge emotional range. And I think it'll be just a great end to the season.
You know, it's a really diverse season. It's a really busy season. And I wonder, can you kind of pull the curtain back a little bit and talk about what it takes from the dancers' perspectives to, and from the backstage perspectives as well, to even get ready for one of these ballets?
That's a great question. And, you know, especially this year with the ballets that we're doing, it's a lot on our artistic team to put these together, especially, you know, a big classic like Giselle, to reviving work from our archive that hasn't been done in a while. There's a lot of preparation that goes into it, even just leading up to the first rehearsal, kind of the planning and the costumes and getting the choreography together. And then once the dancers come in, setting everything again, our stage manager, you know, is already at work kind of on her, you know, what's the run of the show? What are the cues? You know, where are the challenges here? And just kind of sorting through all of those.
And from the dancer's perspective, this is not something you throw together quickly. There's a lot of work and practice and effort that goes into getting, not to mention the day-to-day maintenance of just keeping your body in shape, right?
Right. So our dancers, you know, they have a break in the summer, but they all still take class and find ways to stay in shape. And then they're back in the studios in August, and our summer series features a bunch of free kind of outdoor performances across the state of Delaware. And that's a really nice kickoff to the season because it gives our dancers kind of the opportunity to get some choreography in their bodies and, you know, get back on stage and have those. It's like a nice little warm up to the big season.
And you mentioned the summer season, and I wanted to ask you about that. Where can folks see the dancers this summer?
Yes. So this summer, we have an exciting series of performances. We're going to be at the Lewis Library downstate, the Freeman Pavilion, which is also downstate, and Loblolly Acres, which is one of our favorite places to go because it is a farm and you're outside and there's something for everyone at that performance. It's so exciting. You've got barbecue, you've got face painting, you've got hay rides, and you've got ballet.
And then finally, talking about the upcoming season, which starts in October, when do tickets go on sale?
Tickets are on sale Monday, June 23rd at 10 a.m.
So tickets going on sale, that start date just right around the corner.
Yep.
Claire McGregor, thank you so much. Best of luck with the summer series and of course, the 25-26 season as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to First State Ballet Theater's Marketing Director, Claire McGregor. and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we highlight more stories from University of Delaware student journalists. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this edition of Enlighten Me, we return to the University of Delaware to highlight more work from student journalists there. Pieces produced by UD Communication students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, a longtime First Aid journalist, director of UD's journalism program, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with rising senior Tyler Dodson. Delaware is home to many types of fish, but some were never supposed to be here. Dodson reports those invasive fish can harm local ecosystems, and some are nearly impossible to get rid of.
Fishing is a common pastime, but many anglers are unaware of the silent invaders threatening the Delaware ecosystem. Invasive fish have been threatening Delaware fisheries since the early 2000s, and yet there's been little to no success removing these new species. The northern snakehead was the first fish to make it to Delaware, with its sharp, jagged teeth and long body that gives the fish its frightening name.
You gotta wear gloves. I mean, they have teeth, like insanely sharp teeth. It's like a dragon. Like if you ever, the way they look, they're all slimy.
They eat anything that will fit into their mouth and can survive in almost any conditions. Snakeheads have been known to live in freshwater and saltwater, and they can even breathe air for up to 4 days. Michael Steiger is an aquatic invasive species biologist from the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. He says this puts other fish that are native to the Delaware area at risk.
The problem we have is there are some sunfish species that are threatened and rare in Delaware. So if a snakehead gets moved and released into one of those ponds, they would prey on and could potentially extirpate a rare sunfish species.
But snakeheads are not the only invasive fish making it into local ponds and rivers. Flathead and blue catfish have been starting to call Delaware home as well. These two species have been coming from other states to Delaware through streams and rivers, which makes it difficult for the Department of Natural Resources to stop these fish from getting in.
I'm doing a tracking survey where I track them, and they're freely moving between the Chesapeake Bay and the Delaware Bay through the C&D Canal, which obviously is a problem, but you can't shut the C&D canal. It's a, you know, navigation channel and for shipping.
These fish getting into the bay is a big problem already, but when they make it into an ecosystem like a pond, it can be devastating to the natural fish population.
The reason it's very important in a pond system is because you can think of it as like a fish tank. So there's only so many fish in there. That's the invasive flathead catfish, so they can grow up over 100 pounds. So they'll eat a 2 to 3 pound fish every single day of their lives, and they live 30 to 35 years in the pond system. So that's a lot of predation. So that's why we're removing flathead catfish from Lum's Pond using electrofishing, just because there's limited resources. It's just a mouths to feed issue.
Since many of these fish are coming in from other states, DENREC is fairly limited in what they can do. They use electrofishing boats that stun any fish in the area, and they remove any invasive species as they float to the surface. They also stock fisheries with native fish at the same time. Other than that, the best way to help DENREC in their fight against these invaders is to report any sightings of invasive fish to the DNR's website, and never to transport an unidentified fish between two bodies of water. For UD News, I'm Tyler Dodson.
Thanks to rising senior Tyler Dodson for his reporting. Next, we hear from another rising senior, McKenna Burke, who tells us from sightings of ghosts to eerie deja vu moments, paranormal phenomena allow our imagination to run wild and continue to puzzle investigators.
For generations, ghost stories have been passed down, Whether it's a woman haunting a hallway, a strange whisper, a flickering light, or a shadowy figure at night, maybe it's a coincidence or a paranormal sighting. For some, paranormal activity isn't just something to watch on television. Tammy Petricelli, a medium who connects and receives messages from spirits.
I experience paranormal every day. That's my life.
Over time, embracing the paranormal has become routine for Tammy. She says it allows her to see into the life of the spirits she communicates with.
I'm recalling someone else's thoughts and memories as opposed to recalling my own thoughts and memories.
Some remain skeptical about these mysterious occurrences, but for certain scholars like communications professor Paul Brewer, it's not about proving they exist, but understanding why people believe.
Lots of people believe it, and so I think it's worth studying those beliefs.
The most common mysterious phenomena people report is déjà vu, which is the sense of witnessing something you feel you've already experienced. According to brain and nervous system researchers at the Cleveland Clinic, it usually occurs most often around ages 15 to 25, or at a time in somebody's life that can be stressful, specifically attending college.
It felt like I had seen it before in a dream.
That's Bridget Edney, a junior at the University of Delaware, recalling her experience with déjà vu.
It can feel like time slows down because you're kind of like recognizing the moment.
Psychologists say it can be a memory glitch. Others, including mediums like Tammy Petricelli, feel it's more spiritual.
I feel that's their intuition that they have had saw this in maybe a dream.
Professor Brewer feels that whether it's the paranormal, déjà vu, or other unexplained phenomenon, there is often a need for something more in a difficult world.
You know, people look for meaning and transcendence in a lot of different places. For some people, it's, you know, it's God, a religion. For other people, it's aliens or Bigfoot.
Brewer's research centers on those beliefs. Basically, those who find paranormal events to be real are most likely to be believers, and those who work to debunk it are not. But he points to the fascination society has with the paranormal, especially through the media.
As mass media have become a bigger part of society, they've kind of taken on the role of storytellers and legend makers.
Ghost stories around the campfire have become less and less popular. Instead, they've been replaced by something that reaches every corner of the world. Despite research, most of these phenomena remain unexplained, whether it's stories sitting around a campfire, sightings on TikTok, or conspiracy theories about déjà vu. These stories have endured the test of time. For the ones who have experienced the sinister whispers, ghostly giggles, or dark shadows during the witching hour, the unexplained stay mysterious. For University of Delaware News, I'm McKenna Burke.
Thanks to UD Rising Seniors McKenna Burke and Tyler Donson for enlightening us this week on The Green. And we've hit the finish line for another edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, University of Delaware student journalists McKenna Burke and Tyler Dodson, and Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee, Martin Matheny, and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.